Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. In his prime, the music critics loved Sylvester. The New York Daily News said he made David Bowie look like Lawrence Welk. Sylvester was not only a transvestite street kid from South Central L.A. who became a disco star in the 70s, he also paved the way for many gender-bending artists who would follow in his high heels. And he is the subject of the book, The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. It's just out in paperback. Joshua Gamson is the author of the book, and he joins us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Joshua, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
So people don't really know that Sylvester, as you say, kind of paved the way for another generation of gender-bending artists, Prince, Michael Jackson, Boy George. How did he do? I mean, where does he fit into that kind of timeline from glam rock to these later people?
Well, he was starting out in San Francisco around the time of glam rock. So he actually opened for Bowie in San Francisco. But at that time, I remember a quote from Bowie where the shows didn't sell out in San Francisco. And he said, they don't need Bowie. They've got Sylvester.
Wow.
So, you know, there was that was local, though.
Yeah,
I don't think that was kind of a national impact or international impact at that point. But Sylvester was, you know, in the late 70s, had a moment of international superstardom, and his image was so draggy and androgynous and, you know, anywhere from, you know, glitter and caftans to just sort of more subtle blouse with a big poofy wig. That kind of image, I think, made room for people to play with their gender presentation in the music world a little bit more.
And of course, many...
So I think someone like Boy George, mm-hmm. you know, you'd have to ask them if there's a direct influence, but there was sort of a cultural opening, I think, that Sylvester pushed.
Right, so he was pushing that door open. And many of the people who came after him were obviously a lot more successful than Sylvester was.
Sure.
What was holding him back in terms of being, of keeping that moment of international success?
Well, I think some of it is that his success was in disco, and it was late in the game. So just after he hit, disco started to crash.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was the beginning of the disco sucks movement. So he actually hit, you know, the year before what Ethel Merman was coming out with a disco album. So it was late.
Okay.
And, you know, so I think he sort of, people didn't know what to do. The industry people didn't know what to do with him once disco went sort of back underground in a way.
Well,
I also think that he was openly gay and black and unapologetic was probably not made things harder for him career-wise.
Well, as you just said, you know, the record industry didn't know what to do with him, and probably for exactly those reasons, at least in part. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, Joshua. Tell us the story of Sylvester James. Born in L.A., 1947, grew up singing in church. How does he go from church to drag queen?
Well, he was always a little, you know, effeminate child, and that's cute for a while in the church. This was a Pentecostal church. This was the Church of God in Christ, very serious black church. By the time he was a young teenager, he was more or less pushed out of the church. And had also claimed to have had a sexual relationship with a man in the church.
Literally inside the church building, you mean?
With one of the church members, the choir director. So he left the church, you know, sort of got edged out of the church and left home. And he took up with a bunch of drag queens in South Central LA who called themselves the Discotays, and he was sort of one of the queen bees of the Discotays, who were kind of a cross between a sorority and a street gang.
Mm.
And I think that's pretty much where he honed his style and his drag and his fabulousness.
That's a pretty grim area. I mean, South Central LA. Those were tough streets.
Those were tough streets. These were tough girls. These were really tough girls. You didn't mess with these kids. You know, but their goal was to look great and party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just a very, very rich and creative environment that they made for themselves. So, you know, that's kind of Sylvester's spirit, too, is just, you know, you just don't take no for an answer. So the streets are tough. Well, so you got to be the best looking drag queen on those streets.
Right. And then in 1970, he moves to a very different set of streets.
Yes. He moved up to San Francisco and he never left. He moved pretty much into the hippie scene at that point, and took up with a group called the Coquettes, who were a kind of, I don't know, sexual anarchist, glitter-wearing performance troupe. So mm-hmm. they were kind of the darlings of the countercultural scene for a couple of years in the city, putting on these kind of bent musicals on acid.
and you're right, kind of looking back to Josephine Baker and Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that's what Sylvester did. I mean, the shows were all just in, you know, totally insane, and lots of audience participation and hooting and so on. But Sylvester's role was to come on in full kind of Josephine Baker drag or Bessie Smith drag or some vintage blues diva drag, sing a song, stop the show, and leave. So that's where he, I think, first got his taste of what it would be like to be a serious musical performer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, it wasn't camp. It was serious homage to early black blues and jazz divas
right.
that he would do.
We're speaking with Joshua Gamson. His book is The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. He toyed about with rock and roll, but as you say, eventually found his moment of fame in the disco era with this song, You Make Me Feel Real, Mighty Real, number one dance club hit in 1978. Let's hear a little bit, and then we'll continue our conversation. That is Sylvester and perhaps his most fabulous song, You Make Me Feel Real, Mighty Real. Joshua Gamson is the author of The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. Joshua, you're also a professor of sociology there at the University of San Francisco. You know, where do you, as a, taking a sociologist's view, where do you place Sylvester in this kind of roiling mix of gays and straights, of blacks and whites, of all the people who were in San Francisco and especially in the Castro in the 1970s?
Well, I think he was kind of like the first lady of the Castro. You had at that time Harvey Milk, who was really, you know, nicknamed the mayor of Castro Street, and Sylvester was kind of the cultural icon to Harvey Milk's political icon. More generally, I think, you know, he was this really, crystallizing symbol for a lot of people of gay liberation, and he was the soundtrack to that movement. And you know, I think people underestimate how important music and dancing was in the liberation movements of that time, especially the sexual liberation movements and the gay liberation movement. So, you know, I think he also, in a practical way, brought people together who were very different. So, you know, in the Castro, there was a lot of division, racial division, gender division, and so on. But when Sylvester was playing at places like the Elephant Walk, people just set those aside, or they transcended them, or they danced them away, and felt, I think, some form of, you know, what it feels like to really be free and really be liberated. And that's how I saw his significance, really.
So songs, you know, with titles like Dance, Disco Heat, You Make Me Feel Real. I mean, these songs that could be taken simply at face value as good time, party on kinds of songs actually had a kind of a deeper meaning for the community there.
I guess. I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, they're not, I wouldn't say that you should not take them at face value. You know, they were good dance party songs. That's what he was trying to do. The way people felt them, you know, I mean, simple music can really still bring something out. Those songs were very churchy. There was something very, I mean, you can hear it, I think, in Mighty Real. You can hear the church in there. There was something transcendent about hearing a falsetto male voice that was screaming like a gospel church lady. So I think it's more, you know, how people danced to it, the kind of community that he brought together, than that the music itself had some deeper meaning. It was simple. He didn't take disco all that seriously himself. But the dance scene, the club scene, and so on was really significant for bringing people together, for building solidarity, for letting people feel the opposite of the closet, kind of, letting go.
Joshua, you write about a 1979 concert that Sylvester did at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. What made that such a memorable event?
Oh, boy, I wish I had been there. Partly that, you know, the Opera House, it was the Opera House, and this was the second pop act and the first disco act to perform there. Partly it was that this was this homegrown star at the, you know, the most significant cultural venue in the city. And it brought together, you know, people, I just think, felt a sense of ownership of Sylvester, and he had hit, and he was an international star, and here he was in their hometown singing for them, and people just went nuts. I mean, it sounds like people recount thinking that, I don't know, there was another earthquake because the place was shaking so strongly. Mm. He also had said earlier, a few years before, he was going to play the Opera House. He had just decided, which was a very Sylvester thing to do, to put the fantasy ahead and then step into it.
All right. Well, let's step into it a little bit. Here is a clip from that 1979 concert by Sylvester.
I don't know if y'all have noticed it or not, but these women can sing, y'all. Honey, your ear has to be in your foot to not hear these women can sing. They don't need these dresses. They don't need them jewelries. They don't need that hair. These women can sing, y'all. Now, folks say seeing is believing, right? I done told you everything I could tell you. Now it's their turn to tell you. Mama, you've been around. Girl, I know that you've been around.
I've been around, and you were here all the time. I've been searching, everywhere. But all that love, all the understanding,
a 1979 concert at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. That is the fabulous Sylvester and his equally fabulous backup singers. Martha Walsh, Zora Rhodes, Joshua Gamson is the author of the book The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. It's now out in paperback. And Joshua, there are a couple of things about this. One is, of course, we heard Sylvester's voice there, not singing, but introducing his backup singers, mm-hmm. who would, ironically, as his career, you know, sort of dimmed, their star was really on the rise as the Weather Girls.
Right.
And they went on to have a big hit with It's Raining Men. But at the time, I guess they were known as Two Tons of Fun. Is that the name?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
And obviously the audience really taken with them. Now, before we heard that clip, you said, boy, I wish I were there. So, I mean, you're a little young to have been there.
Yeah, I was in high school at that point.
Were you aware of Sylvester then? How did you come to write this book?
I don't think I was aware of him when he hit. I mean, I probably heard the songs because I was going out to these underage discos as a 11th grader or something, but not really aware. I came to write the book because later I just, you know, about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, he just came into my head and wouldn't leave. It was really kind of odd because I don't have any particular connection to him. I had seen him once from a distance when I lived in San Francisco performing, and that was the year before he died. And I knew his music a little bit, but I didn't have any deep, attraction to it. And as I started to look into it, I just found, I don't know, things that just drew me in about how he was so many things that the society despised, and those became the basis for his stardom. And I found that really intriguing and exciting to think about. But the bottom line was he kind of wouldn't get out of my head.
Yeah.
So at a certain point I said, all right.
I guess I'm wondering whether, you know, he is still seen as a kind of iconic figure in the gay community.
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, the younger generations don't necessarily know who he was. He died in 1988, and, you know, that's a while ago now. People my age and older do, I think, still remember, you know, dancing to his music or have danced since then to his music, and there's something that feels familiar and liberated about dancing to it. So, I think he's still an icon, and I think he's, you know, coming back a little bit. People are bringing him back a little bit.
Well, certainly you are with this book now out in paperback. It's called The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. He didn't die until late in the 80s. So the last few chapters of the book, maybe not the happiest of stories. Let's talk about what happened with the onset of the 80s and disco, as you said before, you know, sort of going back underground. What happened to Sylvester's career?
Well, Sylvester made a decision at a certain point once he left the record label that he had hit on, Fantasy Records. He made a decision to, I think, to stay in San Francisco, pretty much to stay home. And he signed with a small local club, kind of homoerotic club music label called Megatone. He had one hit from there that was big, which was Do You Wanna Funk, that a lot of people will remember. And then a bunch of other club hits on Megatone. So he was really, he became kind of a, you know, just dance music artist for that period of time. At the same time, people were starting to get sick in San Francisco what became eventually clear was AIDS. One of the first people to die was his collaborator, Patrick Cowley, who was a dance music producer and artist himself. From there, really, it was a time period where just people were, especially in the Castro, were just dying rapidly. Sylvester himself became sick in 1986, 87. His lover had died in 85, I believe it was. So he had lost a lot of people, and I think assumed that was, like a lot of people did, assumed that was the way he was going to go. And that was correct.
There are a lot of there are several pages of pictures of Sylvester in your book, and One of them, obviously one of the last of them, is him being wheeled down the street during one of the gay pride parades there. I guess it would have been 88?
Yeah, right. Summer of 88.
How much of a figure was he still in the community by that point?
He was a huge figure at that point, and people were, you know, people knew exactly what they were looking at when they saw him being wheeled down there, and it was actually a very typically kind of courageous or brazen kind of thing to do. He didn't try to hide his illness, and I think he kind of gave his presence as a gift to the people there because he knew that he still meant a lot to that community of people. And people who were there describe gasps and tears and cheers and, you know, a kind of very, very, very strong response to seeing Sylvester, who was so vibrant and so bouncy and so alive, being wheeled down as a sort of, you know, looking like an emaciated old man.
But so making a statement till the very end.
Absolutely.
And again, sort of confounding people's expectations. And with all of the glitter and the baby doll dresses and the knife and fork accessories of the dresses,
right.
I understand you could not call him a drag queen, at least not to his face.
No. I mean, people maybe in his inner circle could certainly get away with it. But no, I mean, there's a great, great moment when he was appearing on The Late Show with Joan Rivers where she said something about him being a drag queen, and he said, "I'm not a drag queen, I'm Sylvester." And that was his philosophy. I cannot be reduced to any one thing.
Well, we've been speaking with Joshua Gamson. He is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco and author of the book, The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. It's just out in paperback. Joshua, thank you for joining us this afternoon on Soundcheck.
My pleasure.
In a moment, coming up, forget the Stradivarius. The new kid on the violin block is the iFiddle. We'll get a live preview of the instrument in a moment with its creator. And later, the acoustic and ethical quandaries of reviving early 20th century pop songs. This is Soundcheck.